is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
I welcome Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President of Stevens Incorporated, traveling the world, former senior advisor to the Secretary of State traveling the world, former Wall Street Journal editorial writer in Asia, in Hong Kong, traveling the world, to tell a story of COVID-19 in the early days. We have from the White House statements in these last hours that there is no consensus about the origin of the COVID-19. Okay. No consensus in the intelligence community in the U.S. I understand. Rarely is there such a thing, and in any event, low probability, high probability. However, I tell a story that is not about intelligence agencies, but my experience. It was February 1st, 2020. I was at Kennedy Airport awaiting outbound to Azerbaijan. I was going there to broadcast and cover an election, very important election. And the gate right beside my exiting gate was a very large aircraft, Eastern China Airlines, a big body aircraft coming in the day after the president and the Trump administration had issued a warning about people coming from China who had been there more than 14 days. There were several filters here, but in any event, the suggestion was this unknown pneumonia that was being reported as early as the end of 2019 by Chinese press and made its way into January 6th, South China Morning Post, where I first covered it on my program with my colleague Gordon Chang. That was turning into an international story, and I puzzled, why is that aircraft landing? It's Chinese New Year. They're coming to celebrate or visit their friends or tour in New York. Welcome. However, at the same time, what about our risk? Mary, beg pardon for a long anecdote, but you were experiencing those same days from another point of view, traveling and at the State Department. What is your memory of when the Trump administration issued the warning on December 31st without adequate information because China was very carefully editing what we knew and what they knew about the virus? What is your memory of how you treated the news? Good day to you, Mary.
Good day to you, John. Well, I remember that we started tracking this virus in December of 2019. And yet, as you say, our ability to discern just how virulent it was and what the mortality rates were was extremely limited because the Chinese government refused all assistance that we offered to them. And it wasn't small. I mean, we offered to send epidemiologists, doctors, nurses, whatever it was that they needed to deal with this outbreak. And all of our outreach was refused. And just to underscore, John, of how little we knew, on that date that you just cited, February 2nd, 2020, Secretary Pompeo and I and the rest of the delegation were in Kazakhstan. So we were not too far from the border with Xinjiang, which was, as we now know, experiencing quite a significant outbreak at the time. You know, we were continuing to travel and to do the business of diplomacy. I think from Kazakhstan, we flew on to Tashkent, and then we took another trip after that in early March for the signing of the half of the Afghan agreements. We went to sign the Taliban agreement in Doha, and that was the last trip that we took for several months. But you know, our attention, particularly in that February period when it started to become clear that this was, you know, something that was much greater than just a citywide outbreak, was really to get Americans out of China as quickly as possible. And we were the only nation that managed to get passenger jets into Wuhan to take our people out. In fact, we took more than 800 people out. And the brave men and women who were on that flight, you know, really didn't know what they were flying into, John. I mean, they were walking out, you know, in hazmat suits. They had outfitted this passenger jet with, all manner of medical equipment. And there was no other nation in the world that did that. And we didn't just do that out of Wuhan. In fact, it's, I think, one of the most interesting and unappreciated aspects of the Trump administration response to the pandemic. We then stood up an entire operation to get Americans all over the world home. tens of thousands of people from every corner of the earth, with the help of the State Department officials on the ground, but also with the cooperation of private industry and private airlines who allowed us to use their jets and pilots to help fly people back home to safety. So, China didn't help at all. Now, our original supposition, which is that it was a product of the Wuhan lab, is gaining traction within the U.S. government bureaucracy 3 years too late. But at least people are starting to come around. And, my concern is, John, that behavior of obfuscation, of outright lies, of propaganda, and the fact that China has suffered no consequences for killing millions of people around the world and covering this all up, and they haven't changed any of their practices in their labs, means that this could very easily happen again.
I want to recover the events of December and January, thanks to the chronology provided in a very important Vanity Fair ProPublica piece that appeared last fall. It's a simple, straightforward line. Early December and December are when the events in Wuhan suggested that the doctors at several hospitals were aware something was very out of order, very out of order. They had respiratory illnesses they'd not seen. On December 31st, the World Health Organization office, according to Vanity Fair and ProPublica, was notified that there was a problem, that there was something irregular. On January 2nd, the Wuhan lab itself, the one we're talking about, identified the genome. January 2nd, 2020. On January 14th, the information provided by Central Authority in Wuhan, Central Authority in Beijing, to doctors in Wuhan. This is according to Vanity Fair and also the early days investigation by the Wall Street Journal. I'm not doing hindsight here. I'm talking about what was available as early as March 6th. There were doctors in Wuhan who were told that there was limited human-to-human transmission. That same thing was repeated on January 15th to Chinese TV. Low probability of human-to-human transmission. All of that information was false.
Right.
False.
Yeah. And the Chinese regime, let's not forget, was aided and abetted by the World Health Organization and specifically by Director General Dr. Tedros, who parroted the regime's propaganda and who did very little to press the regime for more transparency and to allow international help, public health experts, and again, all those people that I cited earlier in the segment. He covered up for them. And in fact, Secretary Pompeo mentioned, this is a passing comment, didn't get a lot of attention, that Dr. Tedros had been corrupted by the regime, although he never elaborated on what exactly he meant by that. But Tedros was reelected to another term just recently with, very little pushback from the Biden team or other of our allies in Europe and in Asia. And so you have to ask, what is the point of the World Health Organization if it can't fulfill its basic duty, which is to deal with significant public health outbreaks? I mean, the COVID outbreak is exactly what the WHO was designed to ameliorate and prevent. So, there are a lot of disturbing lessons that come out of that chronology, John, whether it's just the chronic lying of the communist Chinese regime, which you and I have talked about at length on this program. You should always assume they're lying. It is stock and trade of their diplomacy and all of the people who died needlessly because of it, but also the significant corruption of international institutions like the WHO to serve China's ends, to help them lie and cover up. And, it puts all of us, particularly when it's a pandemic of this scale, it puts the entire world in danger. That's a disturbing conclusion, but it is the only conclusion that I could come to after being part of the policymaking and to seeing the decision making and the non-response we were getting at the time from the Chinese side.
Now we come to right now in this report from the Department of Energy, which has weight because they run the labs. That's the DOE are our labs investigating phenomenon. The report with low probability that the origin was a lab leak. I remind everyone, low probability is how you speak very carefully, especially when you do not have information from the Chinese side. You haven't had access to the Wuhan lab. You haven't been able to interview. And the original understanding by other intelligence agencies or parts of the community that the origin was natural also has low probability, again, because they've not been able to get access to the sources, the possible sources of natural infection. So this is very careful language, but we come to this analogy. We can demonstrate now from the reporting at the time in Wall Street Journal and other publications around the world, and from the Vanity Fair ProPublica piece, that the Chinese authority was deceiving the whole world about the threat of this virus, deceiving through the month of December and January into February, putting Mary at risk where she was traveling, putting me at risk where I was. I was in Baku at the gathering of Asian journalists. But most profoundly, the Chinese deceived their own people. They were dealing with a regime that has no credibility when it comes to human rights, no credibility when it comes to geopolitical statements. So, Mary, I'm not asking for punishment. I'm just asking for your experience over these years. How do you deal with a regime that only lies? How do you adjust to that?
Well, that was a question that we grappled with during the Trump years, particularly when it came to international institutions like the World Trade Organization, the World Health Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization. You know, what do you do when one of the most significant members of all of those groups is simply lying and refusing to follow the rules that China signed up to follow? It undermines the entire point of the organizations, and it inherently corrupts them. And so do you try to get China to change its behavior? We tried that. It didn't work. Do you have mechanisms to kick them out of the organizations? In many cases, you don't. So the conclusion that we came to is that if you can't reform these multilateral organizations like the WHO, for instance, and it has these incredibly deadly consequences, as we saw with the COVID outbreak, then you have to form new organizations that are effective. And so we started reaching out to like-minded nations. There was a group of five or six countries that the secretary started to convene on a regular basis that included nations like Israel and Brazil, Australia, Japan, India, for instance, where we tried to, share best practices, coordinate policy. The United States itself has a lot of unilateral power when it comes to things like public health. USAID is, one of the largest, if not the largest, humanitarian organization in the world. And we just don't leverage it to any great extent. So, there are creative diplomatic ways to solve problems and to muster the strength of multiple nations, but it requires really diligent, hard work on the part of the State Department, and in particular its leadership, to do that. But I have to say, John, I'm really worried that this pandemic is not the first that we've seen come out of China. Recall the SARS outbreak in the early 2000s, and I fear that it won't be the last until we have a change of regime in Beijing that allows for standard, responsible public health practices. But this regime, as it stands right now, and as it's always been, does not respect human life, does not care what happens outside of its borders, does not care what happens to its people. The whole point of that regime, and I'll say it over and over again until I'm blue in the face, is to preserve the Chinese Communist Party and its grip on power. That is the only point of the regime. Everything else is just a side note.
We're headed to Moscow. Threats by Vladimir Putin. Mary Kissel, Executive Vice President, Stevens Incorporated. I'm John Batchelor.
What happened to her, Mario? How could she simply disappear after she was with you?
I don't have answers for that.
48 Hours at CBS News present.
I'm just going to ask you straight out. Did you kill Christy Wilson?
No, I had nothing to do with her disappearance.
Another season of My Life of Crime with Erin Moriarty. Award-winning correspondent Erin Moriarty brings you face-to-face with killers.
I will never say that I'm a cold-blooded killer. I'll never say I'm a murderer.
And the people they took from.
My son died running for his life.
This season, follow the evidence with Erin, beyond the speculation, including in the death of boxing legend Arturo Gatti.
My gut says I don't think he would take his life.
I know my husband killed himself.
Listen to My Life of Crime from 48 Hours on Amazon Music or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Mo Rocca, and it's been a while. But I've been busy digging up even more stories about the people and things of the past that are fascinating me now.
What did your father think of the label, of the whole idea of the Latin lover?
From the screen idols who redefined Hollywood's leading man.
I think it was a love-hate relationship. My dad hated the word macho.
That's what I call the Latin lover type of a role, which is one-dimensional.
To the dog who introduced millions of kids to classic literature.
I remember, on my 10th birthday, I think it was, we were going to go mini-golfing, and I insisted, but we had to stay home for Wishbone first.
Listen to Mobituaries wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to exclusive reporting from CBS News.
Join Gail King, Tony DeCoppel, and Nate Burleson for original reporting. CBS Mornings, weekday mornings on CBS.